Welcome to Headlines. This week, our guest will be Harav HaGaon, Rav Herschel Schechter, the Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. The topic will be bankruptcy and halacha. Next week, the topic will be skulis and Kabbalah. Does anybody really know them today? Should we be giving money to mekubalim who knock on our door? Things like chai rotel for lag boimer. Should we be sending our money there? Our guest will be, for this very interesting topic, Harav Shlomo Gottesman, the Rav of Shari Tefillah and Passaic. We're sitting with Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, Reinu HaGoyin, Harav Herschel Schechter, and the topic today is going to be bankruptcy. What is the halachic perspective of Chapter 11, Chapter 9, and Chapter 7? Shalom Aleichem, it's an honor to have you with us.
Good evening.
So we all know that according to halacha, there is a mitzvah to pay back a debt. It may be both an aseh or a lois aseh, depending on how you learn. It's either priyas bal chayiv mitzvah, it could either be like the chafetz chayim, lois sashik. So the question is, we all know that according to halacha, there is no concept of bankruptcy in chayshe mishpat. But in America, clearly, we have a concept of bankruptcy. So what is the halachic opinion? Let's start with the easier case, where you have a corporation, somebody has a business, they have a big grocery store, and they've bought from many other people. You know, they have all kinds of vendors, and they go bankrupt. And they go to court, and they file Chapter 11, and they the court discharges their debts, and they divide the assets, etc., and they say, okay, you're heilich naki, balashar naki. What is the halacha? And then they called to the entire. They said, you know, we're owed, you owe us $50,000. One of the guy who sells the orange juice says, we never got our money. What is the halachic perspective?
Well, the Gemara has a principle of dina de malchusa dina, that even if you live in a non-Jewish country, and the Goyish government introduces laws, so those laws are binding even on the Jews. Now in the Shulchan Aruch, they quote many Rishonim who explain, this is only if there's a case between a Jew and a non-Jew. But if all the parties involved are Jewish, then we follow Chayshe Mishpat. We follow the halacha. We don't follow the din and the malchusim. So this, this they say, let's say the Jews who lived in Arab countries bordering on Eretz Yisrael in the 1500s used to rely on din and the malchusim, that the government will divide the Yerusha by the sons and the daughters, everybody equally, not in accordance with the halacha. So the Jews, the Balabatim, thought that we follow the din of Malchusa. So the Rabbanim for the Beis Yosef and the other Rabbanim from Eretz Yisrael sent the messengers to explain to them that that's not correct. By a case of Yerusha, when a Jew dies, all of the Yorshim, the sons, the daughters, the grandchildren, the cousins, everybody is Jewish. So we follow the halacha. We don't follow the din of Malchusa. So that should be an issue over here. When someone declares bankruptcy, maybe he'll only be exempt from paying his non-Jewish Bali Chayvis. But the Jews that he owes, we should follow Choshmish. But there is no such halacha as bankruptcy. So many years ago, before Moshe Feinstein came on the scene here in America, there was a great Goyen, Rav Henkin. So at that time, there were Jewish landlords who were renting out apartments only to Jews, and they were doing so, they wouldn't rent to non-Jews because they were ripping off the tenants and charging more than the rent control law permitted them. And these landlords were Talmidei Chachamim, and they felt that it says in Shulchan Aruch that Dina Malchus Adina is not binding when all the parties involved are Jewish, so they don't have to follow the laws of rent control. And the same thing, there were Jewish Balabatim who had businesses, and they were paying, they would only hire Jewish workers because they weren't paying the minimum wage, and they felt that the government has the right to introduce a minimum wage. That's only if one of the parties involved is a non-Jew, or all the parties involved are non-Jews. But if the balabas, the employer and the employees, are all Jewish, then we don't follow Dina Machus Adina. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. So at that time, this was 80 years ago, I guess, 80, 90 years ago. So Rav Henkin wrote a tshuva, which I think is accepted. He said that that's not correct. Dina Machus doesn't apply, the secular law of the land doesn't apply. If all the parties involved are Jewish, that's if you have laws of Yerusha, if you have laws of Mazik, you have laws of Halvoa. So we have a whole legal code that we follow. So whenever all of the parties involved are Jewish, so you follow our halacha. Whenever one or all the parties involved are non-Jews, then they follow Dina Machusa, the law of the land. But the government, the fact that the government has the obligation and the right to institute laws that people shouldn't rip each other off, these kind of laws, minimum wages, rent control, that you can't charge too much for basic necessities, for milk and for cheese and for eggs and for meat. If you're selling ice cream, you're selling diamonds, you can charge whatever you want. But if you're selling necessities, so the government has the right and the obligation to institute laws that people shouldn't rip each other off. That's based on the Pasuk Melech B'Mishpat Yamin Eretz. It's true in Siyar Sena. The government is the Melech. And with the Koyach Avdin and the Malchusa, the government has the right and the obligation to establish such laws that people shouldn't rip each other off. So these laws are binding, even if that's Rav Henkin wrote to Tshuva then. These laws are binding even if all the parties involved are Jewish.
I believe that's in Hapardis, I think, that Tshuva, is that correct?
Sure. At that time he printed in Hapardis. Then it was reprinted and they collected all of the Tshuvas of Rav Henkin and they put them all together. So this is in the collection, right? So it'd be the same over here. The non-Jewish government instituted this takana for the sake of Tikkun HaOlam, that if a fellow made a mistake in business and he fell in, so he'll never be able to pull himself out. He'll be in debt li'olam vod. He'll never be able to krich out of the blotter. So they made a takana that you can declare bankruptcy and shine, and then you can start life again. So this is also a takana le'tikkun hamdina, which the government has the right and the obligation to make such a takana. So this law would be binding even if all the parties involved are Jewish. Even if the people to whom I owe the money are Jewish, still the Dina d'Malchusa applies in such a case.
Now, when the Ramah who says that Dina d'Malchusa is, the Ramah who's Mekel and says Dina d'Malchusa is by everything, as long as it's L'Toyves HaMalchus. So if we assume that Toyves HaMalchus is that people should be able to function in a reasonable and orderly way and shouldn't become wards of the state, The Ramah does not seem to reference that it makes a difference if one of them is an Eina Yehudi.
Okay, good.
So, like the Ramah, Lechair would fit under the standard provisio of Dina d'Malchusa Dina. The problem would be the Shach who says that where it goes neged in Torah, that there is no Dina d'Malchusa Dina.
Okay, but over here, this Rav Henkin Svar is a new Svar, that this was a takana for the Tikkun HaMdina. That people should be able to breathe. There should be a person is choking, so you have to give him a chiyus. So they made a takana that if a person went deeply into debt, and he's afkahak the tzaris, so he can start life all over again. So this all the poskim would agree. This is a new form of dina d'malchusa.
So the question is, the shach who holds that you don't say dina d'malchusa where it goes neged din Torah, because he says im kain batla din Torah, would he agree to the svar of Rav Henkin?
I think so. I would think so.
Even though he holds that you don't say Dina de Malchusa where it's Saisa din Tyra in this case because of...
Yeah, that's the accepted opinion. We don't follow Dina de Malchusa whenever all the parties involved are Jewish, when it's against the laws of the Torah. Shachas has two exceptions to the rule. So he writes one exception to the rule is if you have an instance where the halach has nothing to say, so then you follow Dina de Malchusa. So the Chazanish complains against that shach. There is no such case in the whole wide world. What do you mean? There's no case where the halacha has nothing to say. The halacha has what to say on every instance. Either the halacha says chayv apata, doesn't exist, the chazanish tainus. Then the other exception, he says that shach is difficult. Then the other exception to the rule, the shach writes, and this everybody agrees, the shach quotes this from the Mordechai, that let's say I would enter into an agreement with you, a contractual agreement. I hire you as a worker, or I deliver merchandise to you, I sell, I buy, whatever. And we make a tanai in advance that we want to follow secular law. So if we make such a tanai, you can make any tanai you want, and didi mominus. Master Masha Kasabatar Badovisha bin Mamin, we paskan like Rebuta that tanai kayim, that tanai is valid. So you can make any tanai you want. So if you enter into an agreement like that, I hire a worker, I sell merchandise, and I say, this is on the understanding that we're going to follow secular law. So they make such a tanai, then it becomes the halacha. You made it tanai, so that's the halacha. So the shach says, he quotes from the Mordechai, what if a person is a Jew, is dealing in business with Jews and non-Jews? So when he deals in business with the non-Jews, he has to screw his head on one way to keep in mind what the din in the machus is. when he's dealing in business with the Jews, he has to screw his head on differently to consider what would the halacha have to say. So that's not reasonable. So whenever a person, and what if he doesn't know whether this particular customer is Jewish or non-Jewish? He always has to ask every business associate, any person that he deals with in business, are you Jewish or are you not Jewish? If you're Jewish, you have to make the Tanai like this. If you're not Jewish, make it like that. So we assume whenever a person deals in business with Jews and non-Jews, just like when he deals with the non-Jews, it's self-understood that he's going to follow Dina Machusa. That's the halacha. The halacha is binding. You follow secular law whenever one of the parties involved is not Jewish. So it's an umdina that even when he deals with the Jews, it's considered kilu hisnu. Whatever the minhag hamdina is considered kilu hisnu. And this is clearly the minhag hamdina. The one who deals in business with Jews or with non-Jews always has in mind to follow Dina Machusa. It's considered as if he made such a tanai in advance. The agreement that they're entering into should be on the understanding that we're going to follow secular law. So then the secular law is binding. So that's what the Shach wrote, two exceptions to the rule. When all the parties involved are Jewish, we only follow secular law in these two cases. So one case, he said, was where the halacha has nothing to say. So the Chazon Ish writes, he thinks that it doesn't exist. The halacha always has something to say. You have to break your head to figure out what the halacha says, but the halacha has a position in every instance. Either says chayiv or patur. So that we don't know what the Shach means. And the other Shach, that we do know what he means. Whenever you deal in business with Jews and non-Jews, you have in mind. But here, Rav Henkin said there's an additional case that everyone would agree that Dina de Machusa, even if all the parties involved are Jewish, that's because the government has an obligation to make such a takana. Takana is litikon ha'olam, that people shouldn't rip each other off. They should deal decently with each other. So this takana of bankruptcy was made that people should be able to pull themselves together after making major mistakes. They should be able to start anew.
So does it make a difference whether it's a corporate bankruptcy or a personal bankruptcy?
I don't think so. I think it's the same thing. There is a there is a three-way contradiction in Tosefta's regarding medical malpractice. A doctor was treating a patient, and he made a mistake. Made a mistake doesn't mean that he treated him according to the standard and the patient got sick. That the Aruch HaShulchan says that if you follow the rules of medicine and the patient dies, that's not your fault. Every generation, they keep on discovering that the way they treated the patients in the previous generation was all a big mistake. So but that's the look. If according to medical science, that's how you treat them, so you treat them that's you're not chayv mitam adam amazik. I mean, let's say the doctor made a slip. He made a mistake, and he didn't follow the proper procedure. So what's the din of a reif shekilkel? The doctor made the patient sick. So there's a three-way contradiction in three different Tosefta's. Two are in Bava Kamma and one is in Gittin. So two in Bava Kamma, one Tosefta says chai, one Tosefta says pater. And then the third Tosefta in Gittin says pater medina adam chai medina shamayim. So it's a three-way contradiction. So the Ramban in the Torah Sa'adam quotes some of the Tosefta. So the Or Sameach al-Harambam explains that the three Tosefta's are talking about three different cases. He says from the context of each Tosefta, you see what it's talking about. There's a Mishnah in the end of the second Perek in Bava Kamma, which says, Odamud li'olam be'mishogig be'mimezid, a person causes injury or damage to someone else, he has to pay, even if it's a b'shoigig, even if he mamish made a mistake. There was no intention at all. So the Gemara says that's only by, usually, achoivo b'chavera, one who harms another person, has to pay chamisha dvarim, you have to pay nezek, tzar, ripui, shevis, boishas, a lot of different payments. So nezek, with respect to the nezek, the injury that I caused them, so that the halacha says, b'im shoigig, b'im emezid, b'im b'yoynis, b'im b'rotzon, you have to pay. So that Tosefta says that the Reifei Shekilkel is chayv to pay. The later Tosefta is in Perek HaChovel, where the Mishnayos have in Perek HaChovel the laws of the Chamisha Dvorim, in addition to the Nezik, he paid Tzar, Ripui, Shevis, and Boishas. So that the Gemara says, Boishas, Yironi Chayv, if Niskavein Lavayesh, or Niskavein Lachbo. And Tzar, Ripui, Shevis, you have to have some Korav Lepshia. If it's Mamish, B'Shoigig, Boinus, then Lecholadeus, you're not chayiv, tzar, ripui, shevis, and boishes for sure not. Boishes, you have to have either niskaven levayish or at least niskaven lachva b'chaver. So there the Tosefta is talking about the reifei shekilkel, the doctor harmed the patient. that was mamish b'shegig. It was kemat ba'inis. He was trying to help the patient, trying to treat him, to cure him, and he harmed him. So that tosefta is talking about the rest of the chamisha dvarim. So there it says that you potter, because there's no korav l'pshi over there. The third tosefta in Gittin is in the middle of Mishnah's Gittin. You have in the Mishnah's and in the tosefta's parallel to the Mishnah's. You have a series of Mishnayis which quote Takonis Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam. So the Mishnah beginning of Perek HaShaleach has an example. A man sends a shliach. They didn't have any telephones. They didn't have any fax machines. They didn't have any email or anything. So a man sends a shliach to deliver a get to his wife who lives in a distant location. And then the shliach is traveling. He's not in touch with the husband. And the husband has charata. What did he do such a silly thing for? He doesn't want to divorce his wife. So he convenes a bezin where he is, where the husband lives. And he says, I have charata from making the shliach. I back out. I don't want the shliach to deliver the get. Yeah, but the shliach doesn't know. He has no way to notify the shliach. Shliach goes lefit tumo. He goes to the city where the wife lives. They were separated for a while. He goes to the city where the wife lives. He comes to the bezna. He shows his documents, his shtar hashoah. He was appointed by the husband to function as a shliach to deliver the get. He gives the get. The woman takes the get, and she goes and she remarries. But the husband already backed out from the shlichus. The wife will not know. So she's going to be living in sin with the second husband, and the children will be mazem. It's a whole isik. So the Mishnah, you say that Hachachamim made a takana that you have no right to be mevat of the shliach shalai b'fanav, and they made a takana how to straighten out the mess. So after quoting this takana, then the Mishnah quotes many, many other takanas b'pnei tikkun ha'olam, and then the Tosefta quotes even more takanas b'pnei tikkun ha'olam. So one of the several additional takanas quoted by the Tosefta is that a roife shekilkel, if a doctor accidentally harmed the patient. The doctor was really interested in healing the patient, but by mistake he harmed the patient. That's out of the question. That was the Tosefta in Perek HaChovel, that he doesn't pay, because there's no pshia, there's no korav l'pshia there at all. It's far from being a pshia. But the nezik, he should have to pay. So the Tanoim, this is already the Ramban interprets this, the Ramban in Torah Sodom quotes this Tosefta, and he gives this interpretation. The Tanoim were afraid that, and this happened during our lifetime years ago with all the medical malpractice suits that they had, that good doctors will run away from functioning in the area of medicine because they know that a patient can sue them for billions of dollars and they'll be mechuyev to li'olam vo'ed, to never kriech out of their mess, to never get out of this. So the Tanoim wanted to encourage, the Tanoim or the government, doesn't make a difference. Really, the government has the obligation to do this. That's based on that pasuk in Mishlei Melech Mishpat Yamid Eretz. And if the government doesn't take care of it, then the Drosh HaSaran explains that the Rabbonim have the koyach of Hefker Bezna Hefker. They should take the place of the government. The din really is incumbent upon the government. That's one of the roles of government, to see to it that the people don't rip each other off. They should treat each other nicely. Yamid Eretz, to maintain law and order. So the government wants to keep the good doctors in medicine. They shouldn't run away. The Shvacha doctors won't even, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. So the Shvacha doctors are so Shvach, they won't even realize that they may make a mistake and they may harm the patients. But the good doctors will realize they can kill a person, they can maim a person. So they want to go to a different field. They won't want to stay in medicine. So in order to encourage the good doctors to remain in the field of medicine, so the Bezdin or the government, one or the other, same, either based on Dina de Mahusa or based on Hefke Bezna Hefke, which is a branch of Dina de Mahusa. So they said if the doctor made a mistake and he harmed the patient, he's part of Medina Yadam, he doesn't have to pay. But the Bolot says they Shamayim, the Ikara Dini really should be chayv to pay the Nezik. We're not talking about the Tsari Pushevs Boshes. The Nezik, Mikra Din, Medina Yadam, he is chayv to pay. But the Tanoim or the government made a takana, if he has Rishus, if the doctor is not a Rishus either from the government or not a Rishus from the Bezin, he's a certified doctor that he excels in medicine. So they want to encourage him to stay in the field. So they say, Tolo Yishamu, if you made a mistake and you harmed the patient, we relieve you. So in such a case, since Mi'ikar Adin, he was Mechuyev to pay, so if the doctor sees that he's not going to lose his whole life savings, he will be able to pay. So then, we say that he should pay. So the same over here, let's say a person declared, Pashta says the same should be true regarding all takonis that either the government makes or the bezdin makes. That mikredin, the person is really chayv to pay. Let's say bankruptcy, mikredin, you owe all this money, you have to pay. And the government made a ptur to lashafkes kail chobei, have to give him a chance to breathe. So what if later on he puts his act together and he goes into a new business and he's so successful, he has enough money to pay off all of the chayvus? So then the pashta says that the balotz is the shemaim, he's mukhayv to pay back all the money that he owes, both to the Jews and to the non-Jews.
But let's say, but if it's als minig hasoichrim would be the reason why you would be pater, so then there would be no chiyah b'dei shemayim. As if the reason is, you know, it's customary that these are the terms with which people make deals. In other words, it's like if the stock moves up or down, you know, there's no expectation. If the stock moved against you, that's on those conditions you bought. So if the minig is that according you bought it according to these conditions, you invested according to these conditions, you lent according to these conditions, mm-hmm. And as far as alts minig hasayachrim, I think there's a tshuvas amar sheshach that says that. So then there would lechayre be no chiyuv de shemayim either.
I don't know about here. This, I don't think this is minig hasochmah. Minig hasochmah is a different thing. Like I deal in business with Jews and non-Jews. When I deal with the non-Jews, I have in mind always following Dina de Malchusa. So even when I deal with the Jews, the minig is that is if you, whatever is minig habdin is considered kilu hisnu, and whatever hisnu, so then kol tanai shel b'mamon kayim. Like the Mishnah says, that meikar adin, Mishnah in Bob Metzia says, Mikra Adin, based on the pasuk of Baruch Nafshi, a worker has to work from Alois HaShachat till Tseis HaKohavim. How does it say? Yetzi Adam L'Folo V'Labadosi Adi Orev. So the Gemara says he has to work from Alois HaShachat till Tseis HaKohavim. So let's say I have a worker, and I hire him, and I pay him $2,000 a week. Fine. Then it comes the end of the week. He said he put in a full day's work every day. He wants his salary. He wants $1,000. So I say, but you didn't come at Alois HaShachat. You didn't say till Tseis HaKohavim. So he says, are you crazy? I worked from 9 to 5. Whoever heard of working from Alois HaShachat till Tseis HaKohavim? So the Mishnah says, HaKol K'minig HaMdina. What do you mean, HaKol K'minig HaMdina? Since the Minig HaMdina is that people work from 9 to 5 or whatever the Minig happens to be in that business, so it's Kilo Hisnu, as if they had made it Tanai in advance, that if you work from 9 to 5, you'll get $2,000 a week, and Kol Tanai Shel B'Mamon is Kayim. So that's a different thing. Whatever is the Minig HaSochrim is considered Kilo Hisnu. And if they would have made it tonight, there's no issue of Masa Masha Kasa Batar, but Dovah Shem Mamon. Here it's not because I don't think it's based on Minig Hamdina. This is a different word where Rav Henkel said. The Bezdin and the government has the right and an obligation to make takonis mepnei tikan ho'ilam, mepnei yushuv ho'ilam. The people should give the person another break, give the person a chance. So the Pashto is over here, since it was a takonis Bezdin, a takonis Hamedina, Takon of the government, Tikkun Olam. So that's Balot Zedei Shamayim. If later on he comes into riches, he does well later, he should really pay up all of the chayvus that he had before. I thought this Tosefta in Gittin about the Roifei Shekilkel, that Balot Zedei Shamayim he should pay, I thought that it should apply to all of these Takonas and Mammon. It's different from the case of Minig Asach. Whatever is the Minig is Kilo Hisnu. And if Hisnu said that's a kol tanai shel b'mamon kayim, that tanai is binding, that's the real din. Here it's a special takana.
So there is a marshach that stoles to that gemara to repayment of debtors too. But you're saying that marshach is a chiddush.
I don't know what case he's talking about. He's talking about the government.
He's talking about where there's a partial repayment, where the minig is that they used to let people off for a partial repayment. So he says, based upon minig hasoichrim, a partial repayment would be adequate because that is what was accepted.
Ah, okay. That's a different thing.
But you're saying it's a chiddush.
Let's see over here. The guy owes billions of dollars and then he declares bankruptcy. There was no partial. There is no minig hasochrim over here. Here it's just because Dina de Malchusa, the government said, give the guy a chance. Give him a second chance.
Yeah. So I was asked the following question by an attorney from the Five Towns. He said it's very common in bankruptcy that people buy debt at a discount, and subsequent to the bankruptcy, and in the bankruptcy, you know, there are debts that are not discharged. So he says somebody buys a debt, let's say it was a dollar worth of debt, and they'll buy it for 10 cents because the guy doesn't know if he'll win or he'll lose.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge rules, okay, everybody gets 40 cents. So now this guy has to pay 40 cents. He says, so there are, let's say, hedge funds that'll come along, and they'll buy it for a steep discount, and then they'll turn around, and they'll be tevea the guy the difference between what they paid and what the judge ruled is the face value. He said, al pi halacha, would this fund be allowed to profit off this fellow's misfortune for the debt that they bought at a discount?
I didn't have to shaila, nachamol.
Let's say
someone bought the debt for 10 cents to a dollar
at a discount, and the bankruptcy court
declares.
And the judge says, you know, we're not discharging the full amount of the debt, but we're saying you...
He has the right to collect 40 cents.
He has the right to collect 40 cents. So this guy who bought the debt at 10 cents, this hedge fund now is going to make 400% on their 10 cents instead of 10 cents. Can they do that, or would that be a problem? You're saying because they bought it at such a discount, and the bankrupt, even though they're being... can you profit through the bankruptcy? Would there be any halachic problem? This was a lawyer from the Five Towns asked that I convey this question.
I don't see why there should be a problem. That's whenever you buy, the Mishnais talk about selling debts at a discount because you don't know if you're going to collect later, and then later on you do collect. Okay. I don't see why that should be a problem. I paid 10 cents to a dollar. It was a risk. I may not get a penny to the dollar. So it was nice that I paid 10 cents to the dollar, and that was the deal then. That's how much it was worth because the judge didn't give a decision yet. Then the judge gives a decision. I get 400% profit. It's tough. Good for me. Lucky me. Why should that be a problem?
So in general, you feel that bankruptcy would work both for corporations and for personal individuals as well?
Yes, but that's the Takanas HaMedina.
And that would be Takanas HaMedina.
Right.
And even though the Shach says that Takanas HaMedina would not work where it's neged halacha, this case would be an exception to that. So even like the Shach, it should work.
I would think so.
And that additionally, but if the person can at a later date pay, Lotzeis Bidei Shamayim, he should repay.
I would think so. Then there's another point I would like to mention. Some people are characters, wise guys. So they'll write all of their assets on their wife's name, on someone else's name, and put it in a foreign Swiss bank account no one will discover. And then he declares bankruptcy, and he's really beating the system. The takana that the government made, b'mnei tikkun olam, a bankruptcy, is out of rachmanis for the fellow who fell in, that you got to give him another chance. But there are people who misuse, there are always people who abuse the system, and they declare bankruptcy several times. Every 10 years, they declare bankruptcy again. And each time, they're hiding assets. So there's a famous Taisus in Gittin, where Taisus talks about that first takana that the Mishnah had in Perek HaShaleach. The husband sent a shliach, and he has no way to contact him. The shliach is gone already, 2 weeks. Then the husband has charata, why he gave the shliach a get. The shliach is going to deliver the get to the wife. And he declares, he cancels the shliachs, and he doesn't want the shliach to deliver it. But the shliach doesn't know, so the shliach, by mistake, goes and gives the get to the wife. The wife remarries, she has children. So that's a disaster. So the Gemara says they made a takana in such a case. If such a disaster should occur, so if the husband is mevatel get, shalot b'snei ha-shaliach.
It's batel, the kedushin is batel ma-freya, yeah?
So they say the kedushin is batel ma-freya, and called the mekarish adaita, rabban mekarish, afkir rabban kedushin b'nei. We declared they were never married, and she can be married to the second husband. The children are not mamzer. So Tosis raises the question, what if a fellow knows that his wife had an affair with someone else and she had a child, not from him? So the child is a mamzer.
So let him do this, and this way he'll be able to mevatel the kedushin, and the child will
let him do this. He'll yechol a mamzer and litoyer.
Right.
He'll do this shtickle. So one opinion in Tosis is anachanami. And some poskim thought that maybe we should talk and invoke that once in a while. But the Pashtus is like the other opinion in Tosis. Whenever the Chachamim made a takana, b'pnei tikkun olam, so it only applies if the motivation of the man was not to abuse the system. If the husband knows his wife had an illegitimate child and he wants to be mitayer the mamzer, in such a situation, the Chachamim will never say, afkin rabbani kedushin minei. It's only if lefi tumah, the husband sent a shliach, and then he has charata, and he has no way to notify the shliach, and he doesn't know, he doesn't realize how silly it is that he's mevatel the shliach shalo b'fanav. Shliach is not going to know, the wife is not going to know. So then, because the disaster occurred, lefi tumay, So in such a case, you say that takana de rabban afkina abani kedusha minay. But if he does it in order to abuse the system, so then the takana mipnei tikkun olam doesn't apply. So the pashtus is that rule of taisa, pashtus is like that opinion, that we wouldn't say any time the wife has a mamzer, he can undo the mamzeris l'mafreya. And the pashtus is that it applies to all of the takonas that were instituted mipnei tikkun olam. Like over here, bankruptcy. Bankruptcy was made to give a person another chance. The fella fell in. He'll never get out of the blotta over here. So they made a takana, give him a chance. We'll wipe off all the old debts and we'll start anew. But if the guy's a wise guy, he's just abusing the system. And every 10 years, he declares bankruptcy again. And he keeps on hiding all the money, hiding all the assets, and so on. That be kihai gavna. We have to tell him, we have no way to check what his motivation is. The courts don't know and the bezin doesn't know. But we have to tell him, if you're just abusing the system, lehevi yodua, you should know that you're a ganav, that you have no right to use the bankruptcy principle. I would assume that klal and tesis should apply to bankruptcy also.
Well, thank you very much. We want to thank Rabbi Herschel Schachter, the Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. Thank you very much. You can listen to us on WMCA 570 or WMCA.com on the Zev Brenner Network or at NachumSiegel.com. Our next guest is the world-famous psychologist and Isaac Pitzurchi Tzibur Bamuna, Dr. David Pelkowitz. Welcome, Dr. Pelkowitz.
Thank you. Hi, pleasure to be here. Nice to talk to you.
So, Dr. Pelkowitz, there was an asifa in New York a number of months, or actually it was a year or two ago, about the internet. And a well-known Rav from Muncie got up and he said that the psak that he got from Eretz Yisrael was that whoever has the internet in their home has no chelek l'olam haba. So my question to you is, besides resorting to, in effect, eternal damnation, are there possibly other ways how to deal with the internet? And in particular, how would we deal with teenagers in the internet? According to polls that I've seen recently or studies, as much as 30 to 70% of all internet traffic is pornography. Now, considering that almost every teenager I know has an iPhone, laptops, we live in a world where everybody who has a job has a laptop. How do we deal with it? It's arguably the single biggest crisis towards, Kedushas Yisrael, towards, maintaining purity, sanctity, keeping the spark of tahara that was ingrained to us in yeshiva, that we come out of the Yom Tovim with the Shabbos, is in danger of being extinguished. How do we deal with this really incredible crisis?
Sure, right. So I understand that there are two models: isolation versus inoculation, as Rav Hirsch said, over a century ago. The reality, though, is that pure isolation is often not practical for huge chunks of the community, especially since even if you don't have any kind of digital devices in your home, which would mean no internet-enabled smartphones or games or whatever, the odds are that no matter where you're sending your child to yeshiva, they'll have friends or have some exposure to cousins or friends who do have access. And as they get older, they're going to get access. So maybe if you're living in a very insular community, that could be pulled off. But the life as we live it is one that requires that we address these issues. So, and I agree. I think it's the challenge of our time. Let me just share with you, first of all, in terms of you're talking about an adolescence, the new challenges are that now, ever since 2007, when the iPhone came on the market, younger and younger exposure has become the norm, because even little toddlers and preschoolers who would not have been able to go on a computer because that would require sitting at a desk and having a mouse and sitting on your parents' lap, with new devices like iPads or iPhones, even kids as young as 2 and 3, they can swipe, and they have a natural affinity for these devices. So exposure has become, they're talking now about digitots, kids between age 3 and 5 who who are spending more and more time on these devices, that's both a danger, but it's also an opportunity. Because I think the main point that I want to make is that the research shows that when parents have a lot of clarity about when kids can have access to digital devices, what they could watch, what they could see, and a lot of clarity with very clear rules about internet use, it actually, not only does it work, but kids welcome this kind of input. There's a fascinating study done in a large number of modern Orthodox kids going to Yeshiva High School in California, done by Debbie Fox. And one of the questions she asked a large number of kids going to high schools out in the Beverly Hills area had fascinating answers. She asked them the following question. When you have teenagers of your own, will you handle the internet any differently than your parents handled it with you? And you know that more than half of the kids answered that they're going to be stricter with their kids than their parents were with them, which I find fascinating. And I think that the bottom line there is they among the answers they gave is, if I could only get those images out of my mind that I never should have seen, talking about pornographic images, or even if I could only get back the time that I wasted staying up till 2, 3 in the morning with nonsense. So kids need limits. They need rules. The rules work. Parents just need to figure out how to get the clarity and the will to set up the right kind of structure so that kids are exposed in a way that manages what can be actually an exposure that could very much does not have to destroy their sense of kedusha or their sense of innocence.
You know, there's a story that they say over that a peasant who was somewhat an ignoramus was Shabbos in Lechovich. There was a Reb Noach Lechovich, who was a famed Russian Rebbe, and he was learning Noach, and he asked the Rebbe, he said, it says, "Boy ata v'ishtecha u'shnei banecha el hateva. You, your wife, and children should enter the teva." So he asked him, he said, "Rebbe, how does Noach, his wife, and children fit into a word? Because the word teva can, you know, has a double entendre
word, right,
in Jewish,
right.
Can mean both a word and a box." And the Lechovich thought for a minute, and he smiled. He says, "What a brilliant thought." He says, "Noach lived in such a terrible time. The world was full of chamas. It was full of gezel, arayas, shvichas damim. It was just one of the worst times in history from a moral point of view. It was a moral swamp, a moral apocalypse." And he said, "What do you do in these times of, you know, shifting, groundless morality with your children?" He says, "You have to enter into a teva with them. You have to enter into a meaningful conversation, a constant and significant dialogue. Because without a dialogue, they end up in the miasma. That's the life around us, which is really a swamp today."
See, absolutely. And it's interesting because the research has a very interesting bottom line in terms of what's effective mode of inoculating your kids in this area. It's called authoritative parenting. So authoritative parenting and authoritative rule setting when it comes to use of digital technology is exactly what Chazal told us. All right, so I think three times in Shas it says the key to parenting is to find the balance between smol docha v'imim makareves. So it's exactly that can guide us, and what the research shows is effective in terms of internet use. Smol docha, which means, you know, obviously is the limit-setting part. If it's all limits and no understanding of the child's perspective, it's not going to work. Rules without relationships equals rebellion. So you can't, it can't be, at least in certain neighborhoods where at least some of the kids have access to digital devices, or even if they don't have access, they have friends who have it, or they have friends whose parents have it, the smol docha alone may not be effective. The yamim hakareves, let's say you have all love and all saying yes and no limits, that certainly doesn't work. This is a medium that absolutely can be a disaster if there isn't clear parental guidelines on what kids could see, when they could see it, when they have access, when they don't have access. You need the middle. Which
at what age would you start, Dr. Belkowitz?
At what age?
Yeah.
I would say, ideally, in the best of all worlds, because of since 2007, any kid born after 2007, I would start as early as age 3 or 4.
Wow.
Where even kids who are little preschoolers, because then it's easiest to set up a set of guidelines. And the guidelines, actually, at 3 or 4, are not that different than the guidelines that make sense for older kids.
And what would they be? What would you call
it? Here's some guidelines. Number one, and this is I think that if parents are firm about this, and remember, the parents do have, they're the ones who are paying for the technology, and you could use technology to limit your kids' access. Number one is you keep technology out of the bedroom as much as possible. Children should not have a computer in the bedroom. It should only be in a public part of the house, so parents could constantly monitor. You want the balance between chashdeyu and chabdeyu.
So you're saying, if I had to say it in halachic, you would say you would give a computer the same din that you would have for yichud.
Exactly. Hilchos yichud is the wisest way to think about this. Absolutely. You don't let children sleep with technology because, first of all, the white light interferes with your sleep, and it sets up really bad kind, especially when they're adolescents, and they have FOMO, they have the fear of missing out. It's not unusual for kids to stay up to 3, 4 in the morning and not really get to sleep because they don't want to miss out on, you know, texts from friends with, like, important messages like, you know, are you asleep yet or what's up, you know?
Yeah.
You have to teach your children to ask permission to use technology, so you may have times that they're allowed to use it, maybe for homework, or for whatever approved use you have, but you need to be on top of it. Most families will want to not allow their children to download or buy games and apps themselves. The parents should do it. Parents need to oversee social media use, because anything you do on social media, I don't know if you noticed that there's a new man was... hired from South Africa, was hired to do The Daily Show, who's taking it over from Jon Stewart, which may not seem like a big deal to your listeners, but this is a very important social arbiter of political taste and social taste in the United States. And people were very excited because he seems to be a very talented guy, the new guy they hired. Then they just discovered that when he was much younger, he was posting tweets and emails and other kinds of posts on his social media use that were things that were clearly anti-women, anti-Semitic, and it's totally changed the way people view him now. They're beginning to wonder, should he get the job? And this is something that we have to let our children, we have to save them from themselves. Things live forever on social media when you post it. You have to remember, Ayin Roeh, Ozen Shamaz, Kol Maasecha B'Sefer Nechtavim. I once gave a talk in Twitter headquarters in San Francisco.
Wow.
And the other speaker was the lawyer who's in charge of Facebook. And I'll never forget her opening line. She told the audience, when you check the I agree on Facebook accounts, you know, you have to, in order to use Facebook, you have to check an I agree. It's a lot of small print. Nobody ever reads it. What you're saying is that anything you put on Facebook, we own. And it's not unusual that youthful indiscretions on Facebook come back to haunt you even a decade or 2 decades.
I mean, I don't use Facebook. I'm embarrassed to say I'm an amaretz, but can't you delete your information or account, etc.?
What she's saying, it's possible that it lives elsewhere. There are people who know how to find it elsewhere, especially when you're doing a job search. You know, if you're like a law firm or some kind of
And there are engines that store deleted information. In effect, they take
evidently.
They take
now,
a
I don't know. I don't know.
The
laws
internet.
Changed yeah. recently to not allow that. But parents have responsibility to let children know. There's a tendency to lose sight of how public information posted.
So how do we deal with the child who says, "Hey, Dad, or Mom, you're spying on me"?
It's not very calmly to answer. This is not the same as a private diary. If you have a private diary and you keep it under lock and key, that's fine. But it's not spying because it's public. The whole world could see what you're writing. And that's why the in terms of managing expectations, it makes sense to keep family computers in as public a space as possible, to tell your children that they have to report to you inappropriate games or sites that they come across. You absolutely cannot allow technology use during meals, and parents need to model that. Now, remember what Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say, parents aren't mechanchim but mashbiyim. A mashbiyim is from the Hebrew word for a ramp. It's what you ramp down with your modeling for your children. And you have to designate screen-free time for the entire family, and you have to model that. But the key is you have to make technology a privilege and not a right, and you should have your kids' passwords for social media like Facebook, because it is
Until what age?
I think that you work it out in adolescence, and if as you're monitoring it, your kid has a dialogue with you, and they show you that they're very trustworthy, you could then, in the balance between chashdeo v'chabdeo, you could then pull back more and more because you know that they're very responsible about it.
I mean, but I could see a 16, 17-year-old having a total fit that their parent wants their passwords.
But not necessarily if it's built in from the beginning. That's why the best time to start is when they're very young and you build it in right from the beginning.
So
it may not be very practical later on. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but I'm saying if you set it up this way, and you said, now, of course, kids are going to be able to open up other accounts without you knowing about it. I once spoke to a group of Beis Yaakov girls about social media. I was asked to speak about a group of about 500 girls in a school out of the New York area. And when they were, I think the administrators of the school arranged for me to be with this large group of kids alone for a little while so they could really tell me what's on their mind. And I'm anonymous. So they didn't mind really talking to me. And some of the kids said, you don't think that each of us doesn't have the Facebook account that our parents know about and then the Facebook accounts under a different name that our parents don't know about? There's a phone that they know about, but then there's a phone that you could pick up for $10, $15 in the local drugstore that they don't know about. So the key is really the nature of your relationship with your kid. You want your kid to know that no matter what happens to them, they could come to you and talk to you about it, and it's not going to lead to the loss of your love. You're getting so furious at them that they can't see you as somebody that they could talk to about problems that they have. So the key is like I said before, rules without relationships equals rebellion. It's all about being on top of them without smothering them and getting a dialogue going with them exactly like that beautiful Dvar Torah that you just said a few minutes ago.
So let me make a sikkum. You said number one is it should have a din of yichud on the computers. Out of the bedroom, only in public spaces. Parents should be buying the apps. That would be number two. Three, and what would be the purpose of that?
Well, this is especially for much younger kids. So, for
so
example,
you don't want them doing overly violent games, et cetera.
They're violent games
or sexual content.
Impact. You know, if I hate to interject, but just such a powerful thought. In World War II, one out of four men couldn't kill the first time they were in combat. One out of four American soldiers. So they had to have a special training program for American GIs to teach them how to kill. It's not so easy to kill. Vietnam War, they were ready to have the same program, and they found it wasn't necessary at all. Why? What's the difference between Vietnam and World War II? It was the first generation of soldiers who fought after exposure to television.
Incredible.
And there was so much hergel to violence that it just it wasn't necessary to teach men how to kill because they saw so much of it on television that now they found it much easier to kill.
What an amazing,
they totally
amazing,
canceled the program.
Amazing anecdote.
Is that amazing?
Amazing anecdote.
And the Kal Vachomer, though, is in terms of pornography and what the exposure does. The Satmar Rebbe in 1950 said that his Hasidim saw more in one bus ride from Williamsburg to Manhattan than their parents saw in a lifetime in the shtetl. And compare that to now, where, you know, in your pocket you have access to the most unbelievably graphic and inappropriate pornography. So this is something that we have to take a much more active role in educating our kids, talking to our kids, helping them understand how antithetical this is to our notions of Kedusha. And if we don't, they're going to figure out a way to get to it. Again, some people listening to this may be living in an insular community where there's absolutely no way their kids can get a hold of this. And that's wonderful if you could pull that off. I just don't know how easy it is to pull that off.
Well, this is so, you know, it's so important and it's so not addressed. I mean, go into your average school and who talks about the five steps to, and I want to go over them again because I think they're so important. There's a din of yichud on a computer, which means it's out of the bedrooms in public spaces. Apps have to be purchased only with parents' permission or with in partnership. 3, social media should be monitored by the parents and it should be explained to the children it's in your best interest because one day it'll show up on a job interview or with somebody you're dating. It's there. It lives forever. What did they say? How does it say? Something they used to say, Tolstoy said, what you write with an eraser, with a pencil of lead cannot be erased with an eraser of steel. And it's certainly so on the internet. That would be the third point, social media. The fourth point is nothing during meals. There has to be downtime from social media. You can't allow it to invade and take over your life. It has to have boundaries. And fifth, as you said, it's a privilege. It's not a right.
And also, just to add, because it's an equally important point, add modeling of parents. Otherwise, kids are going to pick up on the hypocrisy.
About the boundaries. It's nothing during meals.
Not also about their own use.
Their own use.
You're sitting down at dinner and checking your iPhone or checking your droid. Your children are going to learn, not based on what you say, but based on what you do. That's the way.
So that would be item number 6. And you say, and it's important to start when children are as young as 3 or 4. So that it becomes.
I think especially if you have a 3, because then it's easiest and it just becomes part of their life. If you build, it's much harder when you have an adolescent and you're doing that. And one other point that I didn't make, your summary is exactly right. You know, I think it's very helpful to summarize it. But the point I didn't make is that in terms of onas dvarim, it is very much easier to be cruel online through texting or through email or through social media than it is face-to-face. Face-to-face, we have the natural feedback of you see how you hurt somebody's feelings and hopefully you're going to be guilty about it and do tshuva. But online, you don't see it. You have a sense of being disconnected. And our judgment online, there's something called the online disinhibition effect, tends to be lessened tremendously. So the top spy in the United States, the head of the CIA, one of the most decorated generals in U.S. military history.
Petraeus.
He forgets that he's texting and that it's kol ma'asecha b'sefer nechtaven.
And halachically, it's true as well because we have, there's many halachas, ein isha me'iza paneh b'fnei baila. What she does to his face, what she says to him, she would never say face to face what she would say behind his back. Halachically, if an isha says, I'm divorced in front of her husband, la halacha, she has a dinah megureshes behind his back because she would never say it in front of his face if it wasn't true behind his back. It's not the case. You have a bal chayv, ein ha'demeiz pun of Bifnei Bal Chayv, but so if the Bal Chayv says you owe me money, he doesn't respond, it's assumed that he owes the money. If the Bal Chayv says it's Shalai Bifanov, it's not the case. So you have the exact disinhibition effect, Shalai Bifanov Lahalach, it's on Genom in this way as well.
So which makes so much sense, and that's something, that's a chinuch issue also. We need to be mechanech our children to understand that you can never take this back. You know, the feathers don't go back into the pillow. And it lives forever in a much more powerful way when you do it online, because it could be seen by hundreds or even thousands.
So item number six would be, remember that the things you can say online are much crueler than what you would say in person. So that would be item number six.
Right.
Dr. Pelkowitz,
ambition effect. Can I add an item seven?
Item seven. We're almost out of time. So
okay, and then so just a quick item seven is also to remember what this does to our sense of being as opposed to doing. Shabbos is about being, not about doing. We have to learn how to live with ourselves and how to be and develop our sense of solitude. Adolescents need that. You know, as the Baal Shem Tov was said to have said, Vavadatem Mehera, also can mean get rid of the rush in your life. And we have to help nurse
Hasser
that
mimenu
yagain. As well.
You're saying, Vahasar mimenu yagain, get the rushing out of Ella. Dr. Pelkowitz, we're out of time. We would love to have you back because I've gotten many requests for adults. Is the internet causing divorce? And how do we deal with it in marriage? And additionally, what should adult internet addicts do to cure themselves? And so many people have become internet addicts, but we're out of time. But it's really it's an honor and a special to have you, and your six steps for parents is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much, Dr. Pelkowitz. Okay, in closing, I'd just like to share with you the following thought. You know, a leading sefer came out in Eretz Yisrael now called Technology and Halacha by Rabbi Tukatsky, where he bashes the internet and talks about the dangers, which I really recognize. But interestingly, in the sefer he says, all comments can be sent to his internet address, which is ironic, isn't it? But I think that it rather than poke fun at it, my point is that he recognizes the reality of it. I mean, the Agoda, which did the huge internet asifa, has a website where they, you know, do webcasts and all kinds of video conferences, and you can watch. So the internet is here. And just like when magazines came out, parents 100 years ago pulled the hair out of their head. And then when telephones came out, they said, oh my God, like our kids will be talking to who knows who. And then when cars... What does that mean? Who will our children be going to, and where will they be meeting, and what will be going on in the front seat and the back seat? So, you know, we can tell our kids not to get into cars and not to use telephones, or we can just be honest and say it's going to require us to be smarter parents. So we can deny the reality or just recognize that it's going to require better parenting. So I'm not pro-internet. I'm just saying that we should recognize the reality that we live in. Next week, a topic is going to be schoolers and Kabbalah. Are they for real? I mean, it's Lag BaOmer. Should we be giving money to Chai Rotel? And is Chai Rotel a school for Parnassa, Shaduchim, Piri of Arabia? Is it a school for people who don't have kids, who need Rafuas, etc.? Mekubalim, who read your palms? Is it anything, or is it just bunk? It's just a way to raise money. We're going to have a worldwide expert, somebody who studied this, the Rav of Shari Tfilim Pesaic, and the editor of the very prestigious Torah journal Yeshurun, Rabbi Gottesman, and he's going to opine on this, and should be a very entertaining, interesting, and exciting conversation and Torah discussion. I look forward to speaking to you next week. Kol Tov.